funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What has the Great Barrier Reef meant to humankind across the centuries? The 1,400-mile stretch of corals off the coast of Australia has existed in its current form for thousands of years, and in that time it has inspired scientists and artists, vexed sailors, and lured commercial developers looking to make money from tourism and resource exploitation. Coral reefs have historically played a very large role as storehouses of atmospheric carbon. But today, beloved as it is by many, experts worry that the Great Barrier Reef has already begun a sort of slow demise due to climate change and ocean acidification. Ian McCallman is a historian, social scientist, and explorer who teaches at the University of Sydney. His new book is called The Reef, The Great Barrier Reef from Captain Cook to Climate Change. Ian, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's wonderful to be in Palo Alto.
I love the story of how you came to feel really connected to the Great Barrier Reef. You agreed to go on a sort of mission as a traveling historian, reconstructing the conditions of Captain Cook's trip in 1770.
Yes, that's right. It was made for BBC and the Discovery Channel. I went on it in all innocence.
Not realizing that you would have to work very hard in ways that you don't normally as a historian.
Absolutely. We had to climb 150 foot up the mast without safety harness. We had 4 hours sleep a night. We ate this appalling salt pork. It made you wretch. You know, it was really a horrific experience at one level.
But at another level, it changed your life.
Absolutely. And I do thank it for that, because sailing through the reef, you're very close to, in an old wooden ship, you're very close to the water, you're close to everything that's happening. You feel nature, and it was an absolutely dazzling place.
The scale of the Great Barrier Reef is hard for us to conceive. I mean, you can see it from space if you're looking the right way. Can you talk about how its size sort of came into focus for you when you were sailing so close to it?
Yes, that's right, Chris. I mean, most of us, even in Australia, sort of tourists who visit the reef, you go to a hotel, you know, and you sort of puddle around. Maybe you go to trip to the coral. But it's just like visiting a little island or something. But what this proved to be was an enormous country. I mean, I think it's bigger than Japan or bigger than Britain and Ireland put together. Hmm. It has thousands of islands on it and multiple reefs. I mean, there's an inside reef, an inner reef, as well as an outer reef. So it is just a prodigious, a kind of mind-blowing country, really, of coral.
And it isn't, as you are explaining to us, it's not just one solid wall. It's sort of reef upon reef, and they're so close together as to form something that seems like one structure.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a story that I was told that an early and very naive minister from the Queensland government turned up at the science the research centre right at the bottom of the reef with a bicycle, thinking he could ride up the reef like a road. But no, it is a myriad of reefs. And when you look at it from above, it is this extraordinary sort of expanse of undersea mounds, I suppose. It's hard to describe. It really is one of the most stunning visual things I've ever seen in my life.
The one advantage that your crew had, even on this reproduction vessel, was that you knew the reef existed, which is something that James Cook had no idea of when he and his men set out from Botany Bay.
That's right. People find it very hard to imagine that he sailed in it for about 800 kilometres without realising he was in the reef, because it, at its southern end, it's very far from shore. It's about 200 miles from shore. So, of course, you can't see anything. You're just sailing along. And suddenly the water seems a bit calmer and more tropical. So, I mean, had Cook any idea that he was sailing in a place where there was corals, he would never have sailed at night because you can't see them. And suddenly, one night, they went from 20 fathoms to none in a matter of seconds, and they hit a reef. And that was the first time that he realized he was in something, some extraordinary, what he later called insane labyrinth of coral.
Because once they hit it, they realized that there was no easy escape from being trapped, and then the ship was damaged.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a miracle, really, that they were saved. We have to remember that these are wooden ships, so they, you know, hull very easily on coral. And secondly, that nobody could swim, including Cook. So if you went down, you just drowned automatically. They were really saved by two things. One was that the big chunk of coral actually broke off and acted as a kind of plug in the wound in the side of the ship. And so they were able to jump the ship off. And they also did something which is kind of odd called fothering, where you put sheep's wool and sheep's dung, sew it loosely onto some canvas, and then run it along the side of the boat, and it's sucked into the wound, and it kind of blocks it. So for that reason, they were, you know, basically a little bit of sheep dung is what saved them from drowning.
How did they survive once they were stranded?
Well, with extreme difficulty, Chris, once they found themselves on this land, it was like nothing they'd ever seen before. They couldn't recognize the animals, and although they managed to kill a couple of kangaroos, that was very early, and you know, it was a tiny kangaroo rather than a full-grown one. And they were literally starving. They already had a scurvy, and they were unable to find any recognizable fruits or vegetables. They were even finding it extremely difficult to catch fish because the conditions are so unusual, so different from the Northern Hemisphere that they were familiar with.
How had Aboriginal peoples who knew of the reefs for probably thousands of years before any Europeans came along, how had they explored the reefs and how did they sort of steward them?
Well, there were myriad Aboriginal clans. Aboriginal clans were quite small, you know, often only about 50 people, and each had a separate dialect. And each had a strip of what they call country, which is more than we mean by country. It means the place that has made you and which is animated by spirits, and you know it intimately. And you are a custodian of it. You've got to keep it clean and happy and flourishing, and in turn it looks after you, it nurtures you. So that was the ethos, I suppose, this caring for country. And they fished fished and caught dugong and so on, but in such a way as to make no impact on the environment, really.
And I suppose with small populations, it's a little bit easier to do that than if you're trying to sustain a lot of people in a densely crowded area.
Absolutely, absolutely.
How do the corals that grow in the Great Barrier Reef form over time?
Yeah, this is a mystery that lots of people found very, very difficult to solve, including Charles Darwin. The mystery is the little coral, it's a tiny little polyp, only they found out very early on that it only lives and can only build coral, which is a waste product. They can only do that if they're in connection with light, if light can penetrate, which means, of course, in very deep waters, they would die. So how is it possible for coral reefs, which go down for thousands of feet, how could that have happened? And the answer that Darwin came up with, and is essentially correct, is that the land was slowly sinking in unison with the corals growing, which meant that the corals were always in touch with light. And then dead corals formed a kind of a sort of wall on which the crust of living coral could operate.
And so justifications have been made over time that it's okay to take the so-called dead coral, but what that essentially does is prevent any new, younger, live corals from growing on top of the base that's been built.
That's right. And it's very difficult to say that a reef is dead. You know, on the one hand, there is this huge limestone wall, as though it's been bricked by some giant. And technically speaking, that is no longer living coral, but it's inhabited by hundreds of different sea creatures. Literally a square foot of it might have 50 different creatures in it. So what we're talking about here is, in oceanic terms, the most biodiverse thing on the planet. Its biodiversity is only almost equals that, say, of the Amazon.
What makes a coral reef so appealing from a biological standpoint for all the different species that gather around it?
I suppose because you can tunnel into it, limestone is relatively soft. You can tunnel into it and you can find protection amongst its many, many contours. And many, many fish and animals actually feed off coral. You know, they've evolved so that they can eat it, but eat it in a moderate way, if you catch my drift. One of the things that's now gone wrong is that a natural predator that normally eats coral, called the crown of thorns starfish, which expels its larvae into the oceans, it's discovered that their larvae feed on pollution. And so this has turned into a plague. It's eaten 40% of the corals. And they can't stop it. It's just like a tsunami. And though it's a natural thing, what's happened is it's been sort of given a huge kick along by the fact that we create pollution on which it can feed.
How do corals act as carbon receptacles?
Well, the main point for the carbon. I mean, they contain calcium carbonate, and they do trap carbon in the same way that marshes do and trees do. The corals inside of them, there's a tiny plant, so you have to think of it as like a little tree inside, and it's feeding off the light, producing photosynthesis, eating carbon dioxide and creating oxygen on which the corals feed. And that little solar panel inside the coral is very, very susceptible to heat, for example. So if the corals heat up 1 degree, they start to be threatened and they're expelled. And then the corals lose all their extra energy and all their color. And in effect, they die. They become bleached white skeletons.
So the idea, people scoff at global temperatures rising by a degree or two or three, but that is absolutely life and death for corals.
Absolutely. You're right. You know, it only needs about 1.5 degrees of warming for corals, say the barrier reef corals, to die. It's really 2 degrees at the maximum will cause them to have this bleaching. I mean, there are some corals in the world, say in the Red Sea, that have evolved over many thousands of years to be able to cope with warm water up to 36 degrees Celsius. But it's all changing too fast for anything to adapt now. You know, adaptation takes thousands of years.
My guest is historian, social scientist, and explorer Ian McCalman. His new book is called The Reef, The Great Barrier Reef from Captain Cook to Climate Change. Join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with University of Sydney historian Ian McCalman. His new book is called The Reef, The Great Barrier Reef from Captain Cook to Climate Change. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So we've already heard a bit of the story of Captain Cook and his crew on the Endeavour shipwrecking against the Great Barrier Reef. Presumably many more stories have never been told because those ships are still lost. There were survivors occasionally. Tell us a little bit about Narcisse Pelletier, or maybe it's Pelletier.
Pelletier, yes. That's a great story, Chris. And it's only really just surfaced in Australia because it was in French, and it only translated in 2009, so very few people know about it. Pelletier was a 14-year-old cabin boy who was wrecked on a reef and managed to escape into a boat with the crew, who made it eventually through the Barrier Reef onto the mainland near the Barrier Reef, you know, adjacent to it. And they basically left him behind when they went to get water. And so this 14-year-old cabin boy was found himself. He was dying of thirst, or already wounded, alone in this vast unknown area. And he was rescued by Aboriginal people who adopted him. And he became an initiated warrior, really successful one. Learned, you know, spoke the local language, had his own canoe that went out to the reef. He was a dugong hunter. He had scarifications across his chest and a big, wooden earlobe. And he was, for all intents and purposes, in his own eyes and in theirs, an Aboriginal person. But unfortunately, a European resource expedition, saw him in 1875, and they so-called rescued him at gunpoint and forcibly took him in the end back to France, where he died in sort of enormous anger and misery at having been taken away from his country and people.
The assumption being back then, in the eyes of Europeans, that nobody would choose to stay with people that they considered, and I'm using this word understanding how anachronistic it is, but people that they considered to be savages.
Absolutely. And indeed, his nickname back in France amongst the people was Le Sauvage. They called him the Savage. And they thought that the doctor who interviewed him, which is how we know a bit of his story, said that he had for 17 years been in a state of suspended slumber, because that's the nature of savagery. It's no understanding whatsoever of how intricately and subtly the indigenous people managed their environment, and a very difficult environment Australia is.
And people who were going to get by in these conditions had to be aware of not using more resources than could be regenerated in a given season or a given year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It seems, for example, that they had a period of time when they wouldn't hunt turtle. A barren period, a fallow period, we might say, so that the turtle could breed. And then they would have their own turtle season. So, you know, they were very conscious of the fact that these resources were given to them by nature, and they were custodians, privileged to eat them or drink them, but never to exploit or eclipse them.
How did people in the world outside of the maritime industry begin to be aware of the reef and want to know more about it?
Yes, I think one of the first examples of people discovering the reef was a paradise rather than a place of terror. It was a journalist who was very ill and went onto one of the islands, Dunk Island, in the 1890s. He was a great follower of David Thoreau, actually, and he had a sort of romantic, my ecological view, I suppose. And he was regenerated by the reef and by the island and living on the reef. And he also was shown all the indigenous knowledge of his island. And he wrote these rhapsodic, beautiful books about the extraordinary way in which the sun, the sea, the natural environment can regenerate human beings, especially those like he was, who were afflicted by the evils of civilization. And those books were tremendously successful overseas in America and in England as well. And so there were a number of, I suppose, two different types of people who spread the word. One were scientists who became more and more intrigued by the reef and more interested in its ecology. And also artists, and you know, who painted the reef and who lived there and got to extol its extraordinary beauties.
How much was there in the 19th century? A lot of snorkeling going on, or would people who wanted to see it sort of get out as close as they could and take quick peeks? How did they explore it?
It was quite difficult, really, because you know, it was extremely dangerous, and the conditions up there are tropical, and so it was quite difficult to explore the reef. In the beginning of tourism was really done by people pretending to be scientists, and they'd go in little groups and actually establish what we would now say would be a resort. But they were actually studying the reef and talking about its creatures and so on. So in a way, the reef was first opened up to the world through ecotourism, which was then overtaken by developer tourism. And you know, and then we went through a phase where the reef was being terribly exploited and overdeveloped.
And is that, I mean, were the people who were overdeveloping the reef and pulling out large sections of it, did they understand the permanence of their actions?
I don't think they did, to be fair. But I think some of them, I mean, some of the governments just simply saw the reef as a resource. As a resource upon which you could gain money, and Queensland, the state where the reef mainly was, depended on the resources of the reef. And later, of course, when oil was discovered in the world, they decided that oil might be there, and so they were very eager to mine the reef. They mined it for oil, for gas, for, would you believe, concrete, and for fertilizer to put on the fields.
So to take the big sections of the reef and grind it up to make fertilizer.
That was the idea. They'd zoned it. The government in the 1960s, mid-1960s, had zoned 80% of the reef, and that's 80% of a place as big as Japan, for mining and gas work.
Ultimately, people may know that the reef was declared a World Heritage Site. Can you talk about the sort of genesis of the sense that the reef deserved protection and what it took to get from point A to point B?
Yeah, that's a lovely story, and I think it's so inspirational for the present, because it was really three people, just ordinary citizens in a way, who got together. One was a poet, Judith Wright. Another one, John Buist, was a painter, one of those painters who lived on the islands, you know. And the third one was a forester, a science forester. And all three of them had become very concerned at this developer exploitation of the reef and its rainforests, because the reef is special not only for its waters, but its shores are fringed by beautiful rainforests that are 46 million years old. And so they combined these three to conduct a major campaign to reach the people of Australia and the people of the world, including the US, to bring pressure to bear on this exploiting government and to force it to become a protected marine reserve. And they succeeded. But the success, and this is what's so important as a message for today, the success was a combination of arts and science, you know, that worked together to tell the story of the reef.
What sort of protection does the World Heritage designation come with?
Well, it was designated a multiple use area. So, and I think fair enough, people are allowed to live on the reef and allowed to make a living from it, but only if it's done in a sustainable way. So there is a fishing industry, and there are many recreational fisher people. There are people who grow sugar there. There are people who do various kinds of extraction of resources. But the World Heritage and the Marine Act itself, which is a bit earlier, absolutely committed existing governments in Australia to protect it from unsustainable usage. And one of those things, of course, was the crushing of corals, or the taking out of corals for some other purpose, you know, for some extractive purpose.
Has the government remained a careful steward of this, or is this the sort of thing, you know, in the United States, it depends really which party is in power and how much they are committed to particular environmental causes?
It's pretty much the latter, Chris. Mm-hmm. To be fair, I think there's been a bipartisan commitment to the reef since its origins in the 1970s. But that bipartisan the sort of protection ethic has gone now. I mean, the government we have now is wholly committed to exploiting coal as a major means of Australia's wealth, and it makes sense to them because you can if you use the reef as a sea lane, it's infinitely quicker than to go round the reef. So what they're doing is turning the reef into a series of coal ports for transporting coal to China. And the process of doing this is utterly destructive. I mean, the most recent one, they're making the biggest coal port in the world. And in order to do this, they need to dredge the reef because it's quite shallow in places. And so they're putting, the most immediately, 3 million cubic meters of silt. They're dredging that and just dropping it back into the sea, where it swirls through the reef, you know, for hundreds of kilometers. And corals can't survive with that. So I think it's an extremely dangerous time again. In a sense, it's a kind of revival of that moment in the 1970s where the reefs was threatened with human destruction. And now it's threatened with destruction from the forces of climate change. But it's worsened, it's exacerbated by making the corals ill, if you like, through silt and pollution and other kinds of development.
It is interesting when you think about the experience for tourists who are brought in there these days under very careful conditions, and then to put a sea lane in close proximity seems just like you're defeating the purpose.
It's crazy. I mean, not even in a kind of utilitarian way. The tourist, it's worth $3.5 billion, the tourist industry. And that's a tourist industry that has been pretty responsible and careful. I don't think that tourism on the whole has been destructive of the reef. So, you know, you could balance that, because that's going to go when the reef's great beauties and special characteristics are gone. So it's the most short-sighted and, you know, greedy, I think, and senseless activity.
Another fascinating figure in this book is William Saville Kent, who is certainly a complicated person. Can you tell us about his story? Even before he ever gets to the Great Barrier Reef, he's a pretty fascinating guy.
Yeah, William Saville Kent was really the reef's first sort of scientist, the first person to tell the world what the reef was like scientifically, when he published a fantastic, most beautiful book in 1893. And that is really how he's known. But the story of how he came to be a reef scientist is extraordinary, because it begins back, when he was a little boy running away from home with his older sister in order to escape the brutalities of his father and his stepmother. And they were brought back. They were retrieved from, they were going to run away to sea. But then later on in 1860, when he was 14, just turned 14, and his sister was 1 year older, they were so damaged by the cruelty to them that in order to act as sort of an act of vengeance, they stole out their 3.5-year-old half-brother, Francis, and cut his throat and killed him.
Hmm.
And William was protected by his sister, who adored him, and his sister was an amazing woman in herself. So she took the rap. She spent 22 years in jail and was seen to be in Madame Tussaud's waxworks as one of the worst criminals of the 19th century. Dickens wrote about her and all sorts of people. Meantime, his brother had become a scientist, and when his sister was about to leave prison, because he'd ignored her, he fled to Australia and eventually to the reef. Though, in fact, she caught up with him, and they did have a reconciliation. She was under a false name. But that flight to the reef and his reconciliation with his sister enabled him really to, I suppose, freed him from some of the psychic doubts and guilts he'd carried. And he had this epiphany of discovering this beautiful place where he was far from civilization and the dangers of exposure. And he painted the reef, painted the animals of the reef, he photographed them, and he wrote about their science and produced this wonderful book.
My guest is historian Ian McCalman. His new book is called The Reef, The Great Barrier Reef from Captain Cook to Climate Change. You can join the conversation. Maybe tell a story of your own visit to the Great Barrier Reef by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with historian and explorer Ian McCalman, author of the new book, The Reef, The Great Barrier Reef from Captain Cook to Climate Change. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Ian, you were saying that William Saville Kent wrote this really amazing, series of books about the Great Barrier Reef, very influential. It is so strange that he seems to have been sort of a disaster in personal life, and yet made these beautiful, sensitive drawings and these really careful observations. Those things, it's hard to put them together in your mind to make a picture of this person.
That's right. I mean, that's why I think it's very important that one always tells the full story of how science is created, because it's a complex human thing. Is a very fallible man, and who gave no indication until that moment that he could create something so lovely and so joyous. And I think a lot of it was the sense of tremendous personal relief he got from having a reconciliation with his sister, who went on, in fact, to become a really selfless nurse under a pseudonym in Australia and lived to be 100, did a great deal of good.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Renee in Dallas. Hi, Renee.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Hi, Renee. Yes, Ian here.
Hi, I appreciate your extraordinary knowledge on the reef. I've got a quick question. I have a friend who swears by the health benefits of coral calcium, which I think is harvested harvested calcium of corals. I'm not exactly sure, but I'd like to know what your opinion is of this.
It's a really interesting question because it's the fact that corals are made from calcium, calcium carbonate, that makes them so vulnerable to climate change because the waters are getting acid, so they're starting to dissolve the corals as a kind of necessary alkaline to balance their pH. So your friend is quite right that they are made of calcium carbonate, but I would certainly discourage him if it's coming from live coral. I'm sure it's not. They're probably grinding it up, which is what people wanted to do to make it a fertilizer. So obviously it has really good health properties as a form of calcium, but it's also what makes those corals terribly vulnerable to what's happening in our climate.
I wish that I could say that this book ends on the happiest note ever, but it really doesn't. You introduce us to someone named Charlie Veron, whose name is not actually Charlie, but he was sort of nicknamed after Charles Darwin.
Yeah, Charlie Veron is a phenomenon, really. I think he's the greatest coral scientist in the world. He discovered and named and identified 20% of the world's corals. And he spent his life diving underwater, exploring coral in the same sort of spirit as Darwin, which is why I especially got that nickname of Charlie. But he has produced a magnificent book that's published by Harvard out here called The Great Barrier Reef, A Reef in Time, The Great Barrier Reef from Beginning to End. Mm. And what he says really is that we've had five major extinctions in the world in the past, and four of those have been because the sea turned acid through the absorption of CO2. And that's exactly what's happening now. So he, in his great lecture that he gave to the Royal Society in England, he answered the question, is the Great Barrier Reef on death row? And his answer was yes.
Does he feel that this is inevitable? Is it now already too late? Do we need to enjoy the reef while it exists and assume that it will be gone?
I think he does, although like all scientists, he's cautious about this. I mean, he knows that nature has in the past found ways to, you know, overcome problems. And it's just conceivable that some form of coral will adapt. And that's what we hope will happen. But whatever happens, it's going to be nothing like the biodiverse, incredible biodiverse hub that it is now. And in truth, I think Charlie believes that it's already committed, as he calls it, to its inevitable extinction, yes.
What kind of records are scientists keeping to chart the declines of the coral? Is it similar to what's happening at the polar ice caps, where people are sort of looking at shrinking ice bodies?
Absolutely. You've hit the nail exactly on the head, Chris. Just in the same way that ice caps contain a long history, the history of deep time, of what's happened to the Earth, so do corals. You know, they are a kind of archive of the past. And so by examining, taking cores right through the coral, you can find out what's happened in the way of, you know, glacial epochs and different epochs of extinction. And so that's what they're saying. Coral is a kind of canary. It's so sensitive to the forces of climate change that it will keel over very early in the process, long before other parts of climate change are really affecting the planet.
Why is the location, or was the location, of the Great Barrier Reef such an ideal place to form this magnificent chain that stretches for so long?
That's because in tropical waters, like, for example, coral grows very well at Miami. It's very similar kind of conditions. So corals thrive in tropical waters with an intense light and certain amount of warmth. But they also need shallow water. And what's happened in the Barrier Reef is that there's a great shallow kind of curtain of land that has sunk, but sunk slowly enough and for the coral to grow. And so what we've got is this curtain of coral that's growing on what was once land, once places where Aborigines hunted kangaroo.
And as the sea levels rise, that's another issue for these species that need shallow water. Just a few inches, I suppose, could make a difference in terms of the light?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. It's going to be a lot more than a few inches, which means large amounts of coral will die.
Mm-hmm.
Again, one hopes that coral can if it could outgrow the rate at which it dies. But it's been made very fragile. It is being made it's being dissolved, really, by acidification in the water as well as the warmth of the water. So it's got this double enemy. And then on top of that, we've got increasing cyclones, as you've noticed in America with your hurricanes and typhoons and so on. They're fiercer and they're coming more often. And, of course, they batter this already fragile coral to bits.
Right. So what happens is the water gets churned up, there's high winds, and pieces break off.
Yes. Massive waves smash the coral into oblivion. That's right. And they break off.
Ian, did you already know about these threats when you went on your trip in 2001?
I had no idea, Chris. No idea whatsoever. I thought that the Barrier Reef was one of those things like the oceans that would go on unchanged forever because it seems so massive. It's one of nature's most massive creations. I couldn't believe that we human beings could kill it in a short time.
It has to be such a strange thing to have just discovered this and made such a profound connection to it and then realize that you're almost too late to the game.
I know. It's very depressing. I mean, the only hope I get is that I've found the communities who've been already bashed around by these forces. For example, there's some people who at Mission Beach have been in two hurricane cyclones in succession have smashed their community to pieces. And they are getting together with a new kind of resolve, with a new kind of, I suppose, a sense of connection between the different groups, you know, tourists, developers, the indigenous people, and environmentalists are working together to try and create at Mission Beach a new kind of ecological community. And that gives me hope.
To what extent is development of, say, buildings and tourism properties limited? And how much can you have? On the one hand, tourists that love the reef will maybe be connected to it and try to be advocates for it, but you don't want too much in any one spot.
Yes, that's right. You've got to balance it. And I think the answer really is ecotourism, both for the forests and the corals and the fish, for people to realize that, you know, to enjoy this, it's absolutely necessary to control themselves and not go and spear fish indiscriminately or catch them indiscriminately. Don't, you know, walk on the corals and break them, and don't cut down the trees.
Mm. What role are indigenous communities having in Australia in this fight?
Well, there's the same kind of a debate that occurs amongst Europeans is happening with them because some communities are, you know, very poor and they're attracted by the fact that oil miners can come in and give them money and develop the community. And so they tend to favor development. On the other hand, there are many communities that feel that their special places, their country, their heartlands are being damaged, their whole way of life is being damaged. And on the whole, the bulk of the communities are very, very active in this sort of environmental movement.
How much oil is actually down there?
There's none. Virtually none. They've not really so far found any oil in manageable quantities. So really the major destruction, I think they've found some gas, and no doubt that will be a factor that will be exploited. There is gas, so we'll get a sort of use of that. But the major damage that's being done really is by turning it into a kind of highway for container ships of coal.
So your first experience in seeing the reef, or your first profound experience, was from this ship that was like the Endeavor. Talk about, I guess you've scuba'd since then and snorkeled and seen the reef much closer.
Yes, I have, and I've been back there to different parts of the reef numerous times. I spent a lot of time there. And it is just like somebody becoming acquainted with a country, a new country, or shall we say in America, you know, moving into a different state.
Mm-hmm.
As I said before, the reef is, in American terms, it's half the size of Texas. So it's a pretty big place.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to spend a lot of time, and there are very many different kinds of reefs, different conditions, different indigenous people. And I'm only really, you know, gradually becoming a passionate advocate for that. And the more I go there, the more it breaks my heart that mm-hmm. it's being smashed.
Do you find that you enjoy your visits more now that you know more, not only about the history, but also about the ecosystem and the biology of reefs?
Absolutely. It's just changed the way I think. Well, really, it's changed my work, too, because mm-hmm. I now run an environmental institute at Sydney University. And you know, before I went on the reef, I wasn't really at all interested in environmentalism. Now, you know, we're committed. We've got 7 or 8 different hubs across all the disciplines to try and do something about how we can adapt positively to climate change. And it's the reef that's brought that awareness to me.
As a historian, are you willing to predict what people might think of our generation 100 or 200 years from now and how we managed this crisis?
I mean, they can only look back with horror.
Hmm.
Because it means that our children and our children's children will never experience what we can experience now. And after all, we are, you know, put on this planet in part, I feel, to pass on its beauties and treasures and wonders and its resources to those who come after us. And we will have used it up. They will never have that chance.
Ian McCallman is a historian, social scientist, environmental activist, and explorer. His new book is The Reef, The Great Barrier Reef, From Captain Cook to Climate Change. Ian, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.